Welcome to the You've Got to Read This podcast. In these recordings, we'll discuss books that we think you're really going to want to check out. This is a podcast of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Library Digital Branch. For this episode, we're going to talk about book pairings, books that go well and relate well to each other. I'm Cameron Smith. I'm an adult librarian at the University City Regional Library, and I'll be discussing In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson and Killing the SS by Bill O'Reilly.
I'm Christy Madron, and I'm a librarian at Morrison Regional Library, and I'm going to be discussing Thinking Machines by Luke Dormel and Illuminae by Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff.
And I'm Kate Hill. I am a senior library assistant at the University City Branch. I will be discussing Beauty Queens by Libba Bray and You Are a Badass by Jen Sincero.
You can find these titles through the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Library catalog at cmlibrary.org.
Okay, so as I mentioned, I'm going to be talking about Beauty Queens and You Are a Badass. And you might kind of be wondering why those two together. It might sound kind of strange, but they both deal a lot with silencing the critics in your mind and in the world and finding out that you are more powerful than you think you are. Beauty Queens is sort of a weird book in a way. The setup is essentially like Lord of the Flies meets Miss Congeniality. So
it is intense.
So these girls are Beauty Queen contestants, and they're competing for Miss Teen Dream. But on their way, they end up in a plane crash, and they're stranded on what they think is a deserted island. They have to figure out how they're going to survive. They have to get food, create shelter, get clean water without any salt in it. And these girls, who are often stereotyped as airheaded or silly or vain, have to pull together and show how bright they really are. And it's really very inspiring. It tackles a lot of issues on the side as well, big issues like racism, gender roles, sexuality, and just a lot of different things. But again, it's really empowering, especially listening about these girls who are coming out of their shell and sort of breaking away from those boxes that they've been put in. And then, of course, you are a badass. I think the title kind of says it all. It is about finding your own power, and it's questioning the assumptions that you've made and that people have assumed for you, the things that tell you you should take the safe route and that your dreams are too big, and kind of denying all of that and really going for it. And it too is very empowering. Both books have a lot of humor and a lot of heart and a lot of honesty. I felt they were both very inspiring.
So nobody gets voted off the island then?
There is some question about it in the beginning. I don't want to ruin that for you.
Well, it sounds like the Beauty Queens really have to learn how to be badasses in order to survive, right?
Well, they do, but in a sense, they're actually already badasses, and no one sees that in them. And I think that's really the message of both books, is you are already a badass. These girls were already badasses. You just have to let yourself believe it and stop listening to society telling you that you aren't.
Wow, that sounds really cool.
So with Beauty Queens, is it more of like the survival of the fittest and that kind of atmosphere?
It's not. You would think maybe it would go there, but they really do create a team and band together. And it's about a little bit finding your tribe too, like finding the people who are going to be there for you. And while there is some, like, are they going to get voted off the island? Are they going to ostracize this person in the beginning? They really end up forming a very strong group.
So there could be some similarities to the Hunger Games, perhaps? Not in the competition element, but banding together and...
Yeah, absolutely. For fans of the Hunger Games, it's a very exciting kind of book. There are a lot of challenges that they're up against. There's wildlife on the island that wants to eat them. There are others on the island who don't want to see them survive. So it's definitely got an element of battle to survive.
Sounds good.
The whole thing was just really good.
Yeah, that's You Are a Badass is on my to-read pile. I've already penciled it in to read for 2019. I just haven't had a chance to get to it yet. So I'm excited to read that one.
What I really liked, it's read, if you listen to the audiobook, which I did, it's read by the author, And she tells a lot of stories about her adventures, especially as a young person and like growing into the person that she is now. And so now she's a life coach, but initially she was like in this crappy band and they were producing music videos and just not caring about the world. And she actually found a lot of success by accident in doing it that way. So it was sort of inspiring to see her stumble and fall and then figure things out.
Well, it already sounds like she was, I would say, pro-risk. If she was already in a band, it doesn't sound like she was taking the safe path already.
She definitely was a risk taker in a lot of ways. But then I think after like that initial like 18 and indestructible phase, she kind of went into, I have to be this particular kind of adult. I have to be responsible. I have to conform to this idea. She really limited herself and her thinking. She was a freelance writer for a while, but she didn't really look into what it would take for her to thrive rather than just survive.
What are some ways she finds that self-affirmation in the end?
She's a big believer in the universe kind of backing you up when you go for it. And so she, as an example, she wanted to live in this particular area of California, and it was an expensive area, and she didn't have the money to do it. But she focused on figuring it out, and it started small. She was living in someone's garage, but she made it the absolute best garage living space that she could, and she continued to fight for it, and she continued to commit to it, and eventually she found she had the resources to move up.
It sounds inspiring.
It really is, and it's very entertaining. Very relatable.
Awesome.
Okay, the book that I chose is In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson, and Eric Larson is one of my favorite authors. I really enjoy his works. And In the Garden of Beasts is a look at Germany during World War II and just prior to World War II, and it's from the perspective of the U.S. ambassador to Germany. His name is William Dodd. And it starts out in 1933, so kind of in the very, very beginning stages of even going through the process of Hitler starting to come to power, people starting to be a little more in tune to at least a new regime, but people are not aware at that point, at least in the U.S., of what, of course, will come down the road. And William Dodd did not have any prior political experience. He was a professor, a longtime professor, so he was really kind of out of the Washington scene, which made him kind of an unusual candidate to be an ambassador, but he was very academic and he had a lot of that knowledge of maybe what could go into place to, in theory, create that good political structure. And he brings along his family too, and that's kind of the interesting element is that his family, they're, especially his daughter Martha, she's kind of a rebel, so to speak, and she has a lot of affairs with some of the Germans, and one in particular was one of the first chief of the Gestapo, Rudolf Diels is his name, and it's just a really interesting look at, like I said, pre-World War II, but also the events that start to transpire during World War II, and it's less about the battles of World War II and all the inner workings. It's more about that political side, and some of the things that the author really kind of delves into are the behind the scenes look at the upper regime and how they didn't always have everything in place, and that they weren't always communicating well with each other. And I mean, that's to be expected, but you think with this kind of hard-nosed regime that's in power that does horrible, horrible things, that you'd think that they had a lot more kind of gelled together, but they really didn't, and they had a lot of issues amongst them. And I would say that I think it really helps to understand the U.S. perspective of the war too, that we really, the U.S. did not really get involved until late, because they really took a kind of closed mind to what was happening and said, oh, well, that's just over in Europe. And based on the World War I experience, they felt the political structure in the U.S. just felt like, you know, we'll kind of leave that on its own, and really didn't want to get involved, and of course there were consequences to that, getting in so late of the war, but it's really because they were ignorant to what was going on in the regime.
And what book did you bring to pair with that one?
The book I brought to pair with it is not a read-alike, and it doesn't go with the actual context of the book of during World War II and pre-World War II, but there's a new book that's out recently called Killing the SS by Bill O'Reilly. And Bill O'Reilly has written a lot of great historical books to kind of cover different events throughout history, but this happens to be a recent release, and it really focuses on the aftermath of World War II and the SS who escaped and went to other countries, and it's the look at hunting those hunters that were out there to try to make them be accountable for their crimes.
Does it go into like how a lot of the Nazis like hid in, say, South America, and the people that went and hunted them down?
Yeah, so it's the kind of the Nazi hunter element. So after World War II, a lot of the Nazi regime, and this specifically looks at the SS in particular, they went to other places, especially South America. So it looks at how they were kind of tracked, and the hunters that actually, you know, tried to hold them accountable and bring them back to Germany so they could face trial. But it's an interesting aspect after the war of even when Germany was trying to rebuild and things were trying to move on from the war, there were still a lot of the regime who escaped, and just kind of finding out how they escaped and where they went and how they were able to cover their tracks, so to speak, is interesting.
Almost a before and after.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it kind of bookends World War II and the experience of the German soldiers.
Yes.
And diplomats and everything.
Exactly.
Is World War II a popular thing that you like to read a lot, or just this time?
Actually, it was just this time, because I'm not much a big nonfiction reader in general, but I kept hearing how great this book was and how great Eric Larson was, and when I started reading, I just couldn't put it down. It was just so exciting, and I've had a lot of interest in World War II in the past, but I really haven't read a lot about World War II. I'd have knowledge of it, but this really was an interesting perspective of the before and during World War II, but not looking at all the battle structures and the really intense fighting of World War II, which I think we all tend to look, you know, hear about more and see in movies, but this was more of that political element that really made it so much more interesting for me, just to see, and to see how ignorant we were in the U.S., because I didn't really realize that perspective. I know we got involved late in the war, not 41, but I didn't understand why, and why the political structure that was in place really kind of turned a blind eye. So that was really an interesting and a different perspective of the war.
Yeah, I heard that in the beginning, before we joined, there were Jewish refugees trying to get into America, and they turned boats away.
Yes.
And they went back to Germany to the camps, which is terrifying and horrible to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So did they cover some of that?
They did, actually, yes. It does mention that the U.S. really did not want to get involved and was not willing to take refugees. And even the German population that was trying to escape, you pretty much had to have money to go through different channels through France and other ways to escape. But if you didn't really have the resources to do so, there was no way to really leave, and the U.S. wasn't willing to accept many people.
Was there a favorite interaction that you had, as far as like one of the most interesting kind of stories about the tension between people or politics? Or
I think for a couple of elements of that, I think the more interesting elements were the daughter Martha, how she kind of played up to these officers and had a lot of relations with the different parts of the regime. But also, I think it was hard because William Dodd, because he wasn't a politician and he was so academic, I think he really thought more about the best in people and was more maybe naive and innocent at times, not to understand a lot of the political working. So there were a lot of interactions where he felt something should be done, and he tried to make some differences, but the Washington political structure at the time really didn't want to hear it and really just kind of took a blind eye to him, so to speak. And so I think there were a lot of different interesting interactions that he had with some of the political structure at the time, and it was kind of eye-opening just to see that even though he was the ambassador, he really couldn't do a whole lot because they really didn't want him to, and they were several times they were in the process of even finding someone else to serve the role because they really didn't feel he was doing what they wanted him to do.
Did it discuss at all if they made changes based on those experiences? Like in Washington, that kind of stuff?
They really didn't until later, and that's when I think most people realize, you know, 41 on, that people were more in tune to what was going on, but they really just didn't really take a lot of value in what he had to say and what his kind of beliefs were in the academic side of things, because it was all about the political workings and a lot of Americans had more ties to Germany, so it wouldn't have been in political favor to kind of distance that relationship. So a lot of people just decided to just ignore what was going on at the time, and they really didn't know. That was the thing too.
It's not like they had the internet.
Right, exactly. And I think William Dodd was trying to understand what was going on too, and when he started figuring out some of the challenges there, and it wasn't really related to what we know about the war, it was just how the political workings of Germany were at the time. And so I think from that perspective it was eye-opening to see, kind of put the war elements aside, but understand what was going on, what got them to that point. We know that prior to 1933 Germany had experienced a huge depression and economically was pretty devastated, and then when Hitler came to power he kind of wanted things to be different and sold the German population on how they could have more prosperous times, I guess. And so kind of looking at that element leading up to it, that was an interesting facet as well.
Yeah, sounds really interesting. And it sounds like it read a bit more like fiction than nonfiction.
It really does. I think that's the great thing about Eric Larson, is he really tells a story. It's all historical fact, and he does a lot of research, but it really is so interesting, and it's not one of the more drab and real detail heavy. He's very detailed, don't get me wrong, but he tells it in a way that's very interesting, and as you mentioned, reads like fiction.
Eric Larson, of course, I've read a couple of his books, and he's very good at writing narrative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So it's very well researched,
yes.
And he paces it very well. That sounds like a great pairing, the two of those together. Well, the books that I'm talking about today are Thinking Machines by Luc Dormel, and that's a nonfiction title. And this book talks about artificial intelligence, so the quest for artificial intelligence, where it's headed, and what elements of artificial intelligence are already in effect right now, like Siri, for instance, or Alexa. We have artificial intelligence in our homes, a lot of us do anyway, already. And of course, artificial intelligence and algorithms that make you feel a certain way on Facebook, or try to figure out how to solve different problems. We have lots of technology problems that we solve with artificial intelligence. Another aspect of artificial intelligence is, you know, where is a good line to draw for the safety and sake of keeping our own humanity? How much are we giving over to artificial intelligence? How much do we need to still keep control? And are we going to be able to keep control in a way that's safe for people? So I have a little bit that I wanted to read, just a bit out of this one. And it's called The Future Risks of Thinking Machines. It's the final chapter, chapter 8. But Elon Musk posted this, and then he deleted it very shortly afterward. But of course, the internet being what it is, if you put it out there, it's forever, especially if you're Elon Musk. But he wrote, "The pace of progress in artificial intelligence is incredibly fast. Unless you have direct exposure to groups like DeepMind, you have no idea how fast. It is growing at a pace close to exponential. The risk of something seriously dangerous happening is in the 5-year time frame, 10 years at most. This is not a case of crying wolf about something I don't understand. I'm not alone in thinking we should be worried. The leading AI companies have taken great steps to ensure safety. They recognize the danger, but believe they can shape and control the digital superintelligences and prevent bad ones from escaping into the internet. That remains to be seen."
Wow, that's intense.
It is a little intense. Most of the book, though, is talking about ways that artificial intelligence is already active in our lives and things that it does to help us, things that we've wanted it to do. I wish my fridge would tell me when I was out of milk, that kind of thing. You know, the futurist positive things, but there's also negative aspects. How machines and artificial intelligence could manipulate people in ways that we haven't expected, even beyond, you know, regular propaganda and misinformation and things. As you can see, there's a fake news problem already on the internet. So what happens when the machines are actually the one controlling the information? So yeah, so there's a lot of problem with that. But the book that I brought to talk about that I think that would pair very interestingly together with this nonfiction is called Illuminae. And it is a book written by two folks together, Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff. And it's written in a very unique style. So it's written like it's an intelligence dossier with printouts of like schematics of the spaceships, because it's a science fiction set in about 500-ish years in the future, figured out how to make wormholes and jump gates and things like that. But basically, corporations are at war with each other, interstellar corporations. One corporation has a secret, unauthorized mining facility on a certain planet, and the other corporation comes and attacks the settlement. And the people, as they're escaping, some of the people, unfortunately, are tested a bioweapon, a bioterrorist weapon, by the group that attacked. The refugees are fleeing in a military ship that happened to be nearby and heard their call for help and, you know, slowed down the attacking group, but their ship got damaged in the fight. And the ship is controlled by the AI, which got damaged in the fight. And it kind of goes a little hell on them. Not 100%, because really, it has their best interests in mind. Course, you know, but things get a little scary. But it's the format of the book is all through like chat logs and information.
Almost like you're the detective breaking it down afterwards.
Yes, or like maybe these companies are going to court to expose what happened, the atrocities that were developed. So not only do we have an AI whose systems have been damaged somewhat in charge of a whole bunch of people, but we also had this bioterrorist weapon, and it was kind of a virus, and one of the ships is infected, and the AI sees what's happening, and he takes matters into his own hands, but the people don't know what's going on, and so it seems really bad. The AI is really, really evil, but according to the AI, he's doing what he needs to be doing.
That's, I think, always a really good thing in books, is when the villain is actually truly in the belief that they're doing the right thing. I think that makes for a very compelling, very interesting story.
Oh, yeah.
Anytime you have a good villain, though, that's cause for a good book.
Well, and this is the first book in a series, so you get to continue on and see what happens later. But I am not even going to begin to tell you the journey that you go on in this book, but it is intense. And there's even like concrete poetry type things. It's not really poetry. It's more like battle, but it's written in the shape of like the words as they are spoken as they're flying through space. So it's very...
Sounds very visually cool.
It is very visually cool. You can listen to this on audiobook. We do have it on audiobook. But just because of the visual information contained therein, I would definitely recommend it in book format. I'm a big audiobook fan, so I listened to it on audio and I read the book just to kind of, so I could compare.
It's always interesting to see the differences. My favorite is always when the author or the writers have like changed the book just a little bit to say things like, if you're listening instead of if you're reading, like little things like that.
Yeah, there's a part in the physical book where they list names of people killed, all the names of 2,000 people. And it creates quite an impact. And it also, in the book, it has very tiny little individual pictures of all the people that were killed in this one attack. And it has quite an impact. When you're listening to that section on audiobook, they're not going to read 2,000 names aloud to you. You know, but it's as if you're at a memorial service and different people are taking turns reading names. So it kind of fades in, fades out for a little while on different names throughout the alphabet. The way that they do it is very good. So there are elements in the audio that still work. But for me, it was so visual. I still felt like it lost a little bit in translation.
Does Thinking Machines address the issue that some people have discussed about the robots affecting the labor market?
It does. You know, it does talk about how robots are here for our jobs. What are we going to do? Because, yes, robots do solve problems for us, and that means that sometimes those problems that we used to have were handled by people. However, interestingly enough, there's always other jobs that get created. When they thought the internet was going to kill libraries, but guess what? We still do a lot of work, and not only in books, but we also help people with technology all the time. So just because, you know, internet and robotics are coming doesn't mean that humans aren't going to adapt and still find ways to be productive and do things that are new and creative. Robots and computers can play a part in some jobs going away, but if you love cooking, you don't want to go flip burgers at Burger King. You want to be a chef at a nice restaurant. So, you know, there's elements of that I think that it's going to be interesting. Another thing will be, how do they plan on where artificial intelligence is going to be needed? How do you balance the needs of a specific culture against another culture? And can the AI, if it was created in this one culture, can it still respect the needs of this other culture at the same time?
It's interesting to me. It sounds like it talks a little bit about how AI, for all that it is artificial intelligence, it still has markers of humanity.
Oh yeah, we got our fingerprints all over those things. Yes, there's a lot of, unfortunately, they've discovered, you know, biases where if you're training with machine learning, you're training in an artificial intelligence, they need to be mindful of being culturally aware and include that in the AI design when they're creating the machine learning. Otherwise, you end up with something way off kilter. Thank you for joining us for the You've Got to Read This podcast. And you can find all of these titles at Charlotte Mecklenburg Library on cmlibrary.org. And you can go online and click on the green catalog button and search for the titles that we're talking about today. I talked about Thinking Machines by Luke Dormehl, D-O-R-M-E-H-L, and Illuminate, I-L-L-U-M-I-N-A-E, by Jay Kristoff and Amy Kaufman.
I spoke about Beauty Queens by Libba Bray and You Are a Badass by Jen Sincero.
And I talked about In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson and Killing the SS by Bill O'Reilly.
We hope you've enjoyed the discussion and have a few new book ideas. Look for upcoming episodes of You've Got to Read This at digitalbranch.cmlibrary.org. And be sure to also like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter for news and photos from Charlotte Mecklenburg Library.